Good morning. It's a Thursday, and that means it's time for Perspectives on WFSU-FM. I'm Tom Flanagan. Thank you so much for tuning in. And if you would like to weigh in via telephone, do that by punching out 414-1234 is our local number. If it's long distance from you to us, it's 800-926-8809. Perspectives at WFSU.org is the email address if that's your preferred means of communication, or you can send us a tweet at WFSU Perspective. Today we're going to be talking about serving Floridians who have a problem, which is mental illness and or substance abuse, which we know occur together in many, if not most, of the cases. And we'll have a ton of statistics that will help to reinforce that in just a bit. Now, we've seen the way the criminal justice system deals with people who wind up behind bars due to mental illness. And we've also seen the Florida legislature grappling with a major overhaul of the state's delivery of mental health and substance abuse services, a bill that died in the last week of session. Has that revived? We'll find that out today as well. And we know that many people are going untreated who could be leading productive lives. So we have three behavioral health experts here with us today to talk about what has been done, what can be done, and really what must be done. Let's go to the phones first and say hi to Miami Judge Steve Lifeman. He's known all over the place for his longstanding efforts to reform the way people with mental illnesses are treated in the criminal justice system. Your Honor, we are honored to have you on Perspectives. Thanks so much for being part of it today.
Good afternoon, and thank you so much for discussing the topic.
We also say hi to Mark Fontaine, Executive Director of the Florida Alcohol and Drug Abuse Association, who is in the thick of legislative reform efforts, even during the special session that's going on right now, Mark.
My pleasure to be here.
Yeah. And we say hello also to an old friend, Myesha Mitchell, health educator who works with those communities that have the least access to meaningful treatment for mental illness and substance abuse. And you were part of a really big symposium over at Florida A&M this
yes,
week.
Yes, I was. It was great. It's the College of Pharmacy and Pharmaceutical Sciences at Florida A&M University sponsored Improving Mental Health for Women, People of Color, and Connecting People and Reducing the Stigma Attached. So the Institute of Public Health did a wonderful job in bringing the community together at all spectrums to talk about this issue. It is an important one for us to address.
Myesha, how many people and from whence showed up for the symposium?
Well, I think a good 100 people were there. I mean, it was a number that was great engagement, you know, from the community, from service providers, from people who were interested in making policy and changes, and also from students. You know, the people who themselves were impacted, several people themselves had issues with mental health and had barriers and concerns that they wanted to share and talk extensively with some of the panelists.
Well, we want to really get into some of the nuts and bolts of that as we go throughout the program today. So I'm just so glad you came in. Judge Lifman, give us a little bit of what you see from that 30,000-foot view. You have been so involved and tied into mental health issues across Florida and actually even beyond for years and years. Where are we right now when it comes to dealing with mental health issues and as a health care issue and not as a criminal justice issue?
Well, you raise some great points, and that's been the real problem. Society has treated mental illnesses as a crime instead of an illness, which they are, and we have not set up the kinds of supports and systems in the community to keep people out of our criminal justice system. In Florida, we have about 130,000 to 140,000 people a year who at the time of their arrest need acute mental health care treatment. And what people need to understand is that people with mental illnesses are absolutely no more dangerous than the general population. In fact, they're much more likely to be victims of violent crimes than perpetrators. And on treatment and medication, their prevalence of violence is actually much lower than the general population. And the other thing I don't think people understand is that people with mental illnesses have recovery rates that are better than people with diabetes and heart disease. It's just a matter of developing a system of care that we can identify people early, get them treated early, and let them live happy, healthy, and productive lives. Florida is an interesting state in that we're, depending which study you look at, either 49th or 50th in per capita funding in mental health services. And that's a real problem. But also our structures are so fragmented and difficult to access that in some ways they push people into the criminal justice system, and that's a real shame. I do, however, think both nationally and statewide we're about to turn a corner. We've, many of us, have been working on this issues for years, and I think the legislature and the Congress are both finally starting to realize that there's a much better way to handle this issue. I was heartened to see the level of interest in the legislature this last session. Senator Garcia from Miami, Representative Peters from the Hillsborough Pinellas area, and Representative Harrell, and Representative McBurney all took a tremendous interest in this area and really pushed some major mental health reform for the first time since the Baker Act was passed over 40 years ago. Unfortunately, the legislation got tied up in the fight over Medicaid expansion, and they did not get it out of the chambers, even though both chambers had passed bills. But I am encouraged that, and I have commitments from all of those folks, that they are going to take it up early when they come back in the new session.
Well, Mark Fontaine, you've been following that, too, very closely, what's been going on with the legislature, even with the truncated regular session, and now we're into the special. And as Judge Lifman said, the battle over Medicaid expansion continues. Where are we? Because you've been watching this day by day.
Well, we still have the budget yet to be resolved, and there's still some outstanding issues in the budget. For instance, the governor and the Senate governor recommended the Senate have in their budget 100 community treatment beds for offenders on probation in an attempt to try to serve them in the community rather than having them penetrate into prison. The same Senate budget also has $2.5 million in new funds to try to deal with offenders stepping out of prison that have a serious mental health problem. We've never really focused on that. And some of the studies are showing that if you pay attention to that, you can reduce recidivism by 50% with that population. So that's still on the table at this point as a possibility that the legislature may choose to fund. As Steve said, with the legislation, there were some big issues that were brought up, good issues, and we're already working on them. We have work groups. Judge Lifman has a work group. My association with the Florida Council, we have a work group. We met with the Department of Children and Families. We're all working together. We're going to try to address these issues so we can come back to the legislature with careful, thoughtful solutions to the issues they raised.
One of the components there, certainly the access, providing more availability to treatment and to programs that can help folks. But Maisha Mitchell, you mentioned something just a few moments ago that stuck with me. You said that there were, in many instances, cultural barriers to seeking help and treatment. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, yeah, Florida is on its path of cultural and linguistic competency in developing a system of care. And what we're finding more and more that people tend not to go to certain providers based on how they feel about that. You know, they have trust issues, of course. There are cultural kinds of barriers that may impact their conversations. It may be language. It could be their values and things of sort. But what we're finding more often is that this idea that Dr. Davis spoke about at the conference, this health-seeking behavior, is that majority of the people end up going to their pastors. And this is cultural because people tend to be more comfortable in that environment. You know, there's some relationships there that can go way back in terms of parents and intergenerational kinds of things. But the main thing that I found very interesting in what he said is that the majority of the people who are seeking health care or seeking a behavioral support go to the local pastors or clergymen, 90% of the population. The other 1 to 5%, 1% go into the mental health professionals, and maybe 1.5% go into the psychiatrist. That is a very interesting dynamic when you think about the people who are in the care provisions are not getting to see the people who need the help. And the people themselves are not comfortable by going there because of certain conditions that they've been experiencing in their life. So those are cultural implications that we see.
Would that be an opportunity, though, instead of trying to change that tradition, is maybe to, in addition to divinity school, maybe more pastors could be given mental health counseling?
One of the suggestions came out of the conference was just that. How do we begin to get people who typically don't have that type of understanding or don't have the knowledge or the skill base to follow that, actually educated and trained, but get them to understand how to refer, you know, get people to the services that they need, because if they don't have the information needed, it's not good for them to hold that person. They need to carry that person and refer them to another location where a person who's mentally ill need to have someone there who knows how to address their issue, who's professional.
And particularly since it's such a big, and go ahead, weigh in, Judge. We have about a minute to our break. Go ahead.
Well, you raise such a great point. The American Psychiatric Foundation, the American Psychiatric Association, has recognized this really serious issue and has begun a national effort to try to bring clergy in and teach them and really how to develop a better referral system.
Yes.
And there's other issues. There's a lot of stigma, even among some of the churches, in terms of what mental illnesses are and where they come from and how they should be treated.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that goes back, believe it or not, a 13th century church document that did a remarkable job identifying mental illnesses and diagnosing it, but also saying that they came from the devil and the treatment was stoning. And that was kind of the root of a lot of the stigma that we have today. And so churches really need to be educated, and pastors and priests and ministers and rabbis, et cetera, so that we can really help people get the kinds of referrals they need. Because the reality is, while those numbers were fascinating, most people are ending up in the criminal justice system.
Exactly.
Their first contact. In fact, 40% of all people with mental illnesses at some point are ending up in the criminal justice system.
Exactly.
Which is the most expensive place to get them treated, since actually they get no treatment there. And we'll get into more of that as we roll on here on Perspectives, talking about mental health, substance abuse, the criminal justice system, and all of that. Your input, too, at 414-1234. Give us a call. Back on Perspectives on WFSU-FM, mental health is what we're focused on today. What's being done to promote improvements in mental health when it comes to the huge number of folks who have problems, which respond to treatment, to therapies, to that sort of thing, and how to make those kinds of things more readily available. Mark Fontaine, you have something to throw in there.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to point out is in 2008, Congress, when they used to pass stuff, Congress passed a bill that, and it was passed unanimously by Republicans and Democrats, called the Paul Wellstone, Pete Dominici Mental Health Parity Act, Mental Health and Substance Abuse Parity Act. And what that legislation says is you can't treat diseases of the brain different than other health diseases, diseases of the body. So that sets us up for, and as rules have come out, what it says is insurance has to, if they cover, they have to provide that is in the Affordable Care Act. That was one of the essential benefits. So people are beginning to realize, but I think the real shift that's taking place, and I don't know if you've seen it, but American Express has an ad. Hmm. And the ad says, there's a lady and she says, I used to have a drug problem. And I went to treatment and I struggled, but I found recovery. And then she walks into her job and they all go, hi, chef, and because she's now working as a chef. And the ad says, for all those second chancers, mm-hmm. American Express is there for you. When the corporations start accepting the fact that addiction and mental illness are societal problems, and everybody has it, and we move on. I think change is taking place.
God, that is a really, really good point. But you still have Myesha Mitchell, one of the problems that I think was addressed during the symposium over at FAMU, which is when you leverage up the rates of stress within any community, but particularly minority communities where you have a lot of income disparity, where you have a lot of family issues like grandma taking care of a couple of generations of kids, where you've got many other kinds of dysfunctions going on, and yet the black woman is supposed to be the bulwark, is supposed to be the strength.
Of course.
And how can anyone continue to do that in the face of all of those kinds of challenges and remain sane?
Well, that is the challenge right there, remaining sane. Most of us are trying to hold up this mantra that we are all of that. In fact, we are not, and that we know that in our community, we're three times more susceptible to have mental health problems than any other groups. Probably because of the stigma that's attached, you know, that goes culturally real deep. The guilt that's associated with having late health-seeking behaviors, you know, particularly when we have to engage the police and calling in to help us with a situation that we can't handle because it's gotten out of control. The black women tend to have the burden of that, you know, because a lot of our men are not with us. They are incarcerated, you know, and many of them incarcerated because they have a drug problem. That does not mean that they have done anything serious. They may be trespassed. You know, they have a mental health issue. And when they continually repeat those, they go into the system. And that's how most people get there involuntarily. We hope that with this work that we're doing now and trying to get more people feeling better, you know, more comfortable, get the spiritual kinds of actions together, going to get the behavior seeking changes that we're hoping for, maybe people will begin to see how important it is that we have to work this as a comprehensive approach, like Mark is saying, that is not isolated, that everybody, and I think what Dr. Davis said soon, we'll have about 50% of our people across the country who have mental health issues. 50% of the population is moving in that direction.
The national statistics are that 18% of the population has a significant mental health problem, or has a mental health problem. 4% of that is a significant mental health problem, which we'd call seriously, persistently mentally ill. And 8% of the population has a substance use disorder problem. So what you're really talking about is all of us. When you look at families and you look at friends and you look at generations, it's all of us.
And Judge Lifeman, what does it cost in terms of the criminal justice system when, again, we may be trending in a more, dare I say, progressive direction here, but still you have an awful lot of folks who are getting locked up? I remember my old pal, the late Larry Campbell, sheriff of Leon County, saying that in some cases about two-thirds of the population of his lockup were afflicted by mental health and substance abuse issues, and he didn't want them there, but he had no other place to put them.
You know, it's interesting. Last week, the police chief of Salt Lake City said that the greatest crime prevention tool that he could ever have would be expansion of Medicaid. And the reason is that so many people with these behavioral health issues are ending up in the criminal justice system. I mean, between 1996 and 2012, the general inmate population in Florida's prisons grew by about 57%. But the mental health population during that same period grew by 153%. And those experienced moderate to severe mental illnesses grew by 170%. So we went from about 8,000 people in prison with serious mental illnesses about 12 years ago to over 18,000 today. It is growing so fast that if Florida doesn't do something immediately to curb this growth, Florida's going to need to build about 10 new prisons over the next 10 years just for the mental health population, which would double in that period of time to about 36,000, meaning Florida would need to spend to build and operate 10 new prisons for 10 years, almost $2.5 billion. That's with a B. And most of these individuals are not in on serious offenses. In fact, the average stay for someone with a serious mental illness in prison is only 2.5 to 4 years. So what you're talking about doing is spending a ridiculous amount of money to warehouse people who are very ill for 2.5 to 4 years and then return them to the same under-resourced, inadequate, fragmented community system that led them into the criminal justice system to begin with. And I wanted to follow up a little bit on the trauma issue because I think that is a horribly underestimated acknowledgement of what really goes on. We know through some studies through SAMHSA, the Federal Administrative Institution that handles substance abuse and mental health, that 92% of all women who were in jail and prison around the United States with serious mental illnesses were sexually abused as children. And about 75% of men who were in jail and prison with serious mental illnesses also have serious trauma issues. And trauma is a major contributor to mental illness because what happens, it's not an emotional reaction, it's a physiological reaction. The body has warning systems, and when you see something really horribly traumatic, it doses cortisone into the brain to get you to flee. And when you can't get out of the way, you basically get overdosed with cortisone, and it literally breaks the brain and causes permanent alterations in brain activity. And that's what PTSD is. And so you have kids that have been abused, and they end up in our systems because we're not treating them early enough. And I got to tell you, this doesn't just happen to kids. It happens to soldiers, which is we see coming back. And it also happens to law enforcement officers who often are in traumatic situations. And we're not acknowledging or addressing any of these issues at the level we should be. And people end up in these deep end systems of so-called care, whether it be a hospital or a jail, with both a mental health issue and a substance use issue, because one of the first things often people do that have these traumatic incidents is they turn to drugs to cope with the symptoms of the trauma, and that often leads them into the criminal justice system. So there, we know so much more today than we knew just 10 years ago, but all of our laws, all of our financing, and all of our systems of care are still 50 years old. That's a huge problem, and we really need to rethink how we deal with these issues, how people are able to access care, and to make sure that they're culturally sensitive, intelligent, with best practices, and we can help people recover.
Mark Fontaine, as Judge Lifman said, that there is very frequently a follow-up on the victims of trauma when it comes to self-medication. What's the incidence of that? You got numbers?
Well, I don't have numbers, but we saw it. Manifested in the pill mills that we had in Florida, where you saw people basically a system that was set up that allowed people to basically go and say, I've got this problem, and get the medication. And in pain is a difficult thing to deal with. So it's very easy to get addicted. I have calls all the time in my office from mothers saying, what do I do? My daughter, my son, what do I do? What do I do? And parents are struggling to find, spouses are struggling to find solutions to their loved ones who are struggling with an addiction or a mental health issue. As Judge Lifman said, I mean, one of the things that I think is very important to say is, and Steve mentioned it, is this system is underfunded, and it has been underfunded, and we can do a better job with the resources we have. But the reality is, it's underfunded. One of the things we talked about this legislative session is we wanted to do a better job of the front door. So if somebody comes in, they can get care. They can get care either in a CSU, crisis stabilization unit or a detox program. Well, when we created the Baker Act that Steve mentioned, we funded the Baker Act, $23 million 20 years ago. We created the Marchman Act, the same thing for substance use disorder. We never funded it. So we have people trying to use that mechanism, but the resources aren't readily available, and And I'm 100%, the earlier you intervene, the more effective you have a chance of changing the pathway.
Mm-hmm. And Mayusha, if you don't have insurance, forget it.
Well, even those who have insurance have having a hard time because of those self-help-seeking behaviors that people have learned. And we find that a lot in women and in men. Women who are now without the husbands or the boyfriends and fathers of their children in the criminal justice system because they have a substance abuse problem, coming back into the community because now you have a problem, you've been assigned in prison, you can't get a job. You know, most time you can't even find housing. You know, you can't get the support you need. So all those barriers are getting in the way, whether you have insurance or not. These social issues. And then the one thing that people tell me all the time is that they have trouble getting the system to understand what the families are experiencing. So a family can come in and say, this person has a serious problem. It's not substance abuse. It's mental health. But they put them in a substance abuse situation. And so then you never can get to the real mental health issue without having to go through that process. And then the persons in the families are suffering because then the person comes right back into that community. And in my own personal experiences, I've seen this happen. I sat in a court not long ago, and even the judges are saying, well, what can I do? You keep coming back in here and you're doing the same thing over and over. This person has a mental health issue. You go to the counselor and the counselor says, well, do you want help? They're asking the person who has a mental health issue. And the person says, no. And then they don't get it because they said they don't want it. And we're saying to the providers, hey, this is what they need. We're not the legal guardians, but we need to tell you this is how they're performing in homes. This is how they're performing in the community. And so we need to find better ways of communicating with providers and families about what the families see happening in the community.
Yeah, I keep going back to maybe having, again, the pastors intervening and being a liaison and saying, okay, you know, I am not the healthcare professional or the mental health professional, but the family has talked to me and I have seen this, that's and right. We need to move this to the next level somehow.
Yes.
Let's go to the phones. George has given us a ring here at 414-1234. Hey, George.
Good morning, Tom, and to this panel. The one thing I'm very concerned about is that these people who are set for life are doing their level best to deny people health care and other help that they need, saying that it's going to cause taxes to go up and all that. Even if that's the case, so be it. Let's get them the help they need and, let's let them be productive citizens if at all possible.
Well, it sounds like some of those decisions, Mark Fontaine, are being made even as we speak right now at the big white building downtown.
They are. And I was reading a statistic last night that we're in this country, we're spending almost $300 billion to deal with the consequences of mental health and substance abuse. So we're already paying for it. We're paying for it in the emergency rooms. We're paying for it in the jails. We're paying for it in the prisons. We're paying for it. Question is, do we want to pay for it in the healthcare system or do we want to pay for it somewhere else? But society is paying for it. When somebody gets a sentence for a drug offense and the sentence is, let's say, 5 years, they're serving 85% of their sentence. We know the average drug sentence is 3.2 years. So society is going to pay $52,000 for that actual offense because they will serve 85% of their time. And that's a $52,000 price tag. The community beds I was talking about earlier are a $10,400 price tag. We got to make choices.
Let's see. I'm trying to do the math on that one. It seems like a lot. Judge Legman, what about mental health courts? I hear a lot of talk about that at least it could mitigate some of this.
Well, mental health courts have a place, but it really is just another tool in the toolbox. And I think more importantly, what we need to be doing is restructuring the community behavioral health system so that we, A, identify kids earlier who are at risk. We've instituted a program in Miami-Dade called Typical or Troubled, where we're now teaching, or I should say the public school system is teaching all of its middle, high school, and elementary teachers on how to identify kids earlier and get them the services they need instead of pushing them into classes with other misbehaving kids and re-traumatizing them, but really try to figure out what's going on and address their issues early so they don't grow up into our system. But what the communities need to do is to develop almost like a filter system where they have a robust, what we call crisis intervention team police program, where we train law enforcement officers how to identify people who are in psychotic episodes, how to de-escalate the situation without escalating it and turning it into a violent situation, and then diverting the individual away from criminal justice to treatment. And then, you know, setting up diversion programs in the criminal system so when people with serious mental illnesses and substance use issues come in, we divert them into the appropriate levels of service. And then the mental health court should be the last program where people who need to be behind, you know, under court supervision are getting that kind of level of resources. But remember, mental health courts only affect less than 1% of people who get arrested with mental health issues. So you want to use that resource appropriate, and you want to get good outcomes. But, there's a lot of good things going on right now, and maybe we should talk to your viewers about that. There's a national effort right now that began 2 weeks ago called Stepping Up, and it's a collaboration between the American Psychiatric Foundation, the National Association of Counties, Council of State Government, working with NAMI, the Justice Department, and we are working with every single county commission in the United States, first to try to get them all to pass resolutions, committing themselves to addressing this problem. And why is it a big deal in the counties? Because the county spends $70 billion a year on incarceration costs, which go nowhere.
Judge, keep that thought in mind. We will return in just a moment with more mental health and related issues here on Perspectives. The local number 414-1234, long distance 800-926-8809, and perspectives at WFSU.org. Welcome back to Perspectives. To the phones we go. Sadeth is giving us a call here on line three, and very patiently she's been waiting. Hi, Sadeth. Welcome to Perspectives. Yeah, Sadeth, you still there? Anyway, let's go to line four then. Neftali is awaiting there. Hi, Neftali.
Hi.
Yes, ma'am. Go right ahead.
I would like to know, what are the early signs of mental health, mental illness?
The early warning signs. Okay, Judge Lightman, you want to give that one a shot, please?
Sure. I'm not a doctor, but I've gone through enough training that I could probably spot it relatively well. And it usually kicks in adolescence. Young men start to show signs before young women, usually in late teens, early 20s. Women usually early 20s. Puberty is one of the triggers for mental illness if you have a predisposition. And usually, you know, sometimes you'll see people withdrawing. Sometimes you'll see their appearance change. Sometimes you'll see them talking to themselves. Sometimes you'll see them putting their hands over their ears and shaking back and forth, which is usually a sign that they're hearing voices. But usually the early signs are withdrawal and, not communicating, not bathing, not eating, and just starting not to take care of themselves. And when people see that, they shouldn't wait, they shouldn't be embarrassed, they shouldn't think it's funny. It's an illness like any other illness and needs to be treated that way. Florida has done what I think is a pretty good thing, is setting up something we call managing entities around the state. And it makes it easier to have kind of a central place that people in the community can go to get referral for services. And so if you don't know who your community mental health provider is, you can call 911 and ask if someone's having a psychotic episode, or B, see if you can track down the managing entity in your community and have them help you get referral to services. Because what we also know is, just like any other illness, the earlier we diagnose it and the earlier we treat it, the much greater likelihood that the person's going to recover quicker, better, and have a better, healthier life.
And I think we can throw in a plug for some counseling and referral resources such as 211 Big Bend. Yes. Here in the Capital Region, which is a, gives access to all kinds of things that most of us don't even know exist when it comes to these sorts of situations. More phone calls pouring in. Thank you so much. Viverge is on the line. Hi, Viverge. Welcome to Perspectives.
Hi, good morning.
Yes, ma'am.
My question is, what suggestions would you make for pastors when referring someone to seek help for mental health?
That's a great question. Myesha Mitchell, what do you think, huh?
Well, you know, I think the pastors are really key. You know, they are the center of what we're talking about here. I would suggest that more training, for one thing, and connecting them up with the people who are experts and getting them to understand the role that they play is so vital and important. Getting more education among the people that they serve, you know, letting them understand about the stigmas, the guilty aspects of it, the way that we treat people differently in our communities because they have a mental health problem, the isolation that occurs, how we can bring people in. And I must say many of them are doing great work with that already, but to really heighten that kind of sensitivity among the people that they're serving is a key aspect. More education, bringing people in from the professional groups to teach about it, you know, that's open. Everybody would welcome having someone to come and talk to them, and the professionals are wanting to come to the community and share. So more engagement together, forming partnerships with each other, with the criminal justice system, with the local police, with the people who are oftentimes the first responders are those policemen who see these conditions firsthand and learning more about how they operate and finding ways to engage pastors and the police and the community professionals in dialogue and discussion. That's probably the best way to start. And then get your people to understand that it's not a problem that we can't solve with regard to mental health. That is our issue, and we have to come together to recognize that people need help. And it starts with us as well. We have a major role to play.
Yes, and we must trust in the Lord, but also the Lord helps those who help themselves.
Exactly.
So
you got to do that.
Okay. And what kind of resources are out there for that, Mark Fontaine? Is there anything formal?
Well, in every community, there is a mental health center. Often there's a substance abuse agency in this community, Appalachian Mental Health, in this community, Disc Village. So you have very good community services. Sometimes the access is limited because the resources are limited in terms of what they are able to do. One of the trends that is happening after the Miami Herald article last year on the 477 deaths in the child welfare system, one of the things that was surfaced there was that 68% of those parents had a substance abuse problem, and another 12% had a mental health problem. So you had 80% of those people had a significant issue that wasn't being dealt with. And so what we're seeing now, and the legislature recently funded some funding both for adolescents with mental health issues, for families. It's called family intensive treatment. But what you see is you see this movement of the workers going into the communities and into the homes. Yeah. And that's a very different dynamic than you come to us. It's like we're going to go where the care is needed.
Exactly. And that's a good point because the community has a role. I don't think we've stepped up enough with our part because in our families, even personally, we see people who have drug and alcohol problems. We don't think necessarily that this person needs to be referred. This is just them. This is where they are. And so we get used to this behavior until it gets to a point where you can't handle it anymore and the person has encounters with the criminal justice system. So recognizing early on, you know, with people coming in like the FACT program, you know, into a community and talking with families, engaging the family in the discussion, because we do know that if you're helping a person individually, you have to help the whole family. Otherwise, we cannot address the problem adequately. So more help from each of the providers that we have in our community, children particularly in the schools, the teachers, the people who are coming in contact with these children early on need to be involved in that process as well. It's like cancer. Early detection really can help prevent so many and save so many lives.
We're back with Sudeth after she was inadvertently dropped, and we appreciate your calling back, Sudeth. Go ahead. You're on Perspectives. Yes, Sudeth.
Oh, hi. Sudeth Cummings.
Oh, yes. Go right ahead.
All right. As an Episcopal priest, I just need to correct a misperception that you all obviously have about the training of clergy. In the mainline churches, Presbyterian, Lutheran, Methodist, Episcopal, etc., mental health training is required, and we have clinical pastoral education, and pastors are ready and do listen and refer frequently. In fact, there's lots of pastors who are trained mental health providers anyway. I suspect that you're not familiar with most churches, but nevertheless, that's the standard and has been for a long time. Furthermore, the panelists who brought up the 13th century document linking mental illness to demon possession, just remember what the state of the law was back then, and the church never officially taught that. And it certainly not has been the standard for ages and ages and ages. And if there's shame about mental illness, it's, I think, largely because of personal embarrassment in our culture that worships perfection, physically and personality and mentally, more than it is anything that the church ever has anything to do with. So that's my comment.
Oh, good point, Father. Really appreciate you kicking in there. And you're right. Most mainstream denominations do have that as part of the seminary training and preparation for ordination or consecration. But there are some other denominations maybe that aren't quite as comprehensive when it comes to the training of pastors. But a great point there. And as a long-time Catholic, I remember what happened with the Inquisition and a lot of the misperceptions there of demonology and mental health issues and all that. That was in society overall, wasn't just the church for sure. Let's see. Rita was on line three. I think she was on there first. Hi, Rita. Welcome to Perspectives.
Oh, good morning, you all. Thanks for taking my call. I have worked in a psychiatric hospital in South Carolina for a couple of years, and it's been several years ago. But South Carolina had a series of group homes. One of the major problems with people with severe mental illnesses, when we rely on the family to take care of people, that hear voices and are delusional and won't take their medication, families burn out. And when people can be placed in a safe environment that's not an institution, but it is a group home, that really can be very beneficial. They have some freedom. Somebody gives them their medication. It's a big job for the families. And, I know somebody mentioned in-home counseling. Well, and that works, but that's what we're talking about. A couple hours a month, and I don't think that's adequate.
Thank you, Rita. I appreciate it. Judge Lightman, what about that with the concept there of group homes, and do individuals have to be, shall we say, referred to those kinds of facilities via the Baker Act, or how does that work?
Often for the diversion programs that we run in South Florida, we are diverting people to adult living facilities, group homes, when they leave. It is an alternative for some people, and for some people it works fine. But most of those facilities are really horribly under-resourced. They don't get the level of services that they need. And what we find is a lot of people with mental illnesses don't want to live with other people with mental illnesses because of the stigma that occurs. And that a lot of these individuals do very well, living on their own with some supportive services. And so we really try to stress more supportive housing for this population as opposed to group homes. But for some people it works, and for those it does, we, try to have availability for them. But there is a huge lack of housing for people with mental illnesses. About 50% of the people in Florida who get arrested with a mental illness are homeless at the time of their arrest. And getting people housing is one of the critical components for individuals for their recovery when they leave the criminal justice system. And it's something that we have not addressed well. Florida does not do a very good job in that arena, and it's something that we really do need to do a better job with.
Okay, and Mark Fontaine, same thing with some of the halfway houses, particularly like down in the Deltona area and all that, where there's a plethora of them down there.
Yeah. The legislature passed legislation this year called sober home legislation. And so what they're doing, what the legislature did is it's encouraging those recovery residences to get certified. And the law creates a certification for the residents and a certification for the resident administrator in following national standards, so that you would have some standard for those programs. That bill's sitting on the governor's desk. We anticipate he will sign it. And it's the first attempt at trying to address that issue. And then what the bill also says is that providers, licensed treatment providers, will refer only to certified. So you'll have a standard that we'll be reaching towards.
Okay. I think we can get in one more call here on Perspectives. Hi, Sam. Thank you for hanging on and welcome.
Yes, I've been listening to your program, and I'm walking away terrified that our system is so broken and failed. I have a stepson that's supposed to be coming home to live with us. He's got PSD, and I'm having second thoughts already because there's not enough programs out there to help. All y'all done is scare everybody and demoralize people with all this negative talk about how this doesn't work and how that doesn't work. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, let's see if we can maybe mollify some of the negativity here. Mark Fontaine, what do you think?
Well, I didn't think we were being negative. One of the things that I was going to say earlier is that the legislature has, over the years, has funded a fairly robust system of substance abuse treatment for offenders. They realize that 58% of the people on probation and 65% of the people in prison have a drug history. And we have, we have community programs, we have programs in the institutions, and we have reentry programs. Do we have enough? No, but there's a growing understanding that's the kind of thing we need to do in order to be successful. So there is, Sam, there is some very successful programming happening right now with the child welfare, some very successful mm-hmm. programming taking place with addressing families. And I'm encouraged.
Okay, Myesha Mitchell, yeah. any reasons for optimism from your end?
Oh, definitely optimistic about the future. You know, that there are programs, I listen to what the judge is saying, the drug courts, you know, the sober homes, and then finding ways that we can actually put the emphasis on the mental health side of things, I think is what we're trying to move forward with, because we have the chemical and substance abuse components pretty much covered, I think. I'd like to just encourage you, Sam, and others, you know, in terms of supporting families who have family members who are experiencing trauma or any other illnesses that may be considered mental health. We, in our community, constantly are trying to find ways to get people involved because we know it's a comprehensive approach. And so we're trying to address the issues that may have gaps, you know, the barriers that are there. And we always are saying to people, you know, there is hope. You know, we can make change here, you know, so join us and help and make the change and make your voice heard.
And we are talking about it. And you get the final word, Judge Steve Lifman.
Well, I think people should be optimistic because treatment works.
It does.
We absolutely know. The key is getting our legislators to provide enough access so people can access those services and get the help they need. But treatment works, Sam, and that's where you should be optimistic. I think people also have to have an obligation not just to wring their hands over this, but to pick up their phone or send a letter to their local legislator and let them know how important these issues are to them, because
that's
they don't hear from enough people. And so if we're able to expand access, treatment works, we can help people, and your stepson should not be concerned about coming in. But before he comes, you should call the local provider and make mm-hmm. an appointment and figure out what resources are available and help them set up. And if he's a vet, find out where the local VA is, because they're doing remarkable
great work
in this arena, and they can get people help.
Judge Steve Lifman, it has been a delight and a privilege to have you on the program today. We thank you so much, and anytime we have some questions about this, you know who we're going to call, right?
Take care. I appreciate it. Anytime.
Thank you so much. Also, Myesha Mitchell, it is wonderful to see you always,
thank
ma'am.
You. And prevention is the key.
And that is what we are going to be focusing on. And finally, of course, Mark Fontaine. It was great having you on the show, Mark, and really appreciate all your input, too.
Thank you.
Perspectives is produced by WFSU-FM in Tallahassee. We have some great guys sitting back there pushing the buttons and making it all happen today in the persona of Sawyer and Lydell. And I'm Tom Flanagan. Coming up next Thursday, something we alluded to in the course of this program, street violence in Tallahassee and how the community is responding. We'll talk more about that right here next week on Perspectives.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcasts. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.